The shadow of the times fell upon him, and, like Buddha, he took to the religious life and at first set no limit to his austerities. 50 miles from Rome is Subiaco, and there, at the end of a gorge of the Anio, beneath a jungle growth of weeds and bushes, rose a deserted palace, built by the Emperor Nero, overlooking an artificial lake that had been made in those days of departed prosperity by damming back the waters of the river. Here, with a hair shirt as his chief possession, Benedict took up his quarters in a cave in the high southward-looking cliff that overhangs the stream, in so inaccessible a position that his food had to be lowered to him on a cord by a faithful admirer. 3 years he lived here, and his fame spread as Buddha's did nearly 1,000 years before under similar circumstances. As in the case of Buddha, the story of Benedict has been overlaid by foolish and credulous disciples with a mass of silly stories of miracles and manifestations. But presently we find him no longer engaged in self-torment, but controlling a group of 12 monasteries and the resort of a great number of people. Youths are brought to him to be educated, and the whole character of his life has changed. From Subiaco he moved further southward to Monte Cassino, halfway between Rome and Naples, a lonely and beautiful mountain in the midst of a great circle of majestic heights. Here it's interesting to note that in the 6th century AD he found a temple of Apollo and a sacred grove and the countryside still worshipping at this shrine. His first labors had to be missionary labors, and it was with difficulty that he persuaded the simple pagans to demolish their temple and cut down their grove. The establishment upon Monte Cassino became a famous and powerful center within the lifetime of its founder. Mixed up with the imbecile inventions of marvel-loving monks about demons exorcised, disciples walking on the water and dead children restored to life, we can still detect something of the real spirit of Benedict. Particularly significant are the stories that represent him as discouraging extreme mortification. He sent a damping message to a solitary who had invented a new degree in saintliness by chaining himself to a rock in a narrow cave. "Break thy chain," said Benedict, "for the true servant of God is chained not to rocks by iron, but to righteousness by Christ." And next to the discouragement of solitary self-torture, it is Benedict's distinction that he insisted upon hard work. Through the legends shines the clear indication of the trouble made by his patrician students and disciples who found themselves obliged to toil instead of leading lives of leisurely austerity under the ministrations of the lower-class brethren. A third remarkable thing about Benedict was his political influence. He set himself to reconcile Goths and Italians, and it's clear that Totila, his Gothic king, came to him for counsel and was greatly influenced by him. When Totila retook Naples from the Greeks, the Goths protected the women from insult and treated even the captured soldiers with humanity. When Belisarius, Justinian's general, had taken the same place 10 years previously, he had celebrated his triumph by a general massacre. Now, the monastic organization of Benedict was a very great beginning in the Western world. One of his prominent followers was Pope Gregory the Great, 540 to 604, the first monk to become pope in 590. He was one of the most capable and energetic of the popes, sending successful missions to the unconverted and particularly to the Anglo-Saxons. He ruled in Rome like an independent king, organizing armies, making treaties. To his influence is due the imposition of the Benedictine rule upon nearly the whole of Latin monasticism. Closely associated with these two names in the development of a civilizing monasticism out of the merely egotistic mortifications of the early recluses is that of Cassiodorus, 490 to 585. He was evidently much senior to Pope Gregory and younger by 10 years than Benedict, and like these two, he belonged to a patrician family, a Syrian family, settled in Italy. he had a considerable official career under the Gothic kings, and when, between 545 and 553, the overthrow of those kings and the great pestilence paved the way for the new barbaric rule of the Lombards, he took refuge in a monastic career. He founded a monastery upon his private estates, and set the monks he gathered to work in quite the Benedictine fashion. Though whether his monks actually followed the Benedictine rule that was being formulated about the same time from Monte Cassino, we don't know. But there can be no question of his influence upon the development of this great working, teaching, and studying order. It's evident that he was profoundly impressed by the universal decay of education, and the possible loss of all learning and of the ancient literature by the world. And from the first, he directed his brethren to the task of preserving and restoring these things. He collected ancient manuscripts and caused them to be copied. He made sundials, water clocks, and similar apparatus, a little last gleam of experimental science in the gathering darkness. He wrote a history of the Gothic kings, and what's more significant of his sense of the needs of the time, he produced a series of school books on the liberal arts and a grammar. Probably his influence was even greater than that of St. Benedict in making monasticism into a powerful instrument for the restoration of social order in the Western world. The spread of monasteries of the Benedictine order or type in the 7th and 8th centuries was very considerable. Everywhere we find them as centers of light, restoring, maintaining, and raising the standard of cultivation, preserving some sort of elementary education, spreading useful arts, multiplying and storing books, and keeping before the eyes of the world the spectacle and example of a social backbone. For 8 centuries thenceforth, the European monastic system remained a system of patches and fibers of enlightenment in what might otherwise have been a wholly chaotic world. Closely associated with the Benedictine monasteries were the schools that grew presently into the medieval universities. The schools of the Roman world had been altogether swept away in the general social breakdown. There was a time when very few priests in Britain or Gaul could read the gospel or their service books. Only gradually was teaching restored to the world. But when it was restored, it came back not as the duty work of a learned slave, but as the religious service of a special class of devoted men. In the East also, there was a breach of educational continuity. But there the cause wasn't so much social disorder as religious intolerance, and the break was by no means so complete. Justinian closed and dispersed the schools of Athens in 529, but he did this very largely in order to destroy a rival to the new school he was setting up in Constantinople, which was more directly under imperial control. Since the new Latin learning of the developing Western universities had no textbooks and literature of its own, it had, in spite of its strong theological bias to the contrary, to depend very largely upon the Latin classics and the Latin translations of the Greek literature. It was obliged to preserve far more of that splendid literature than it had a mind to do.